Welcome to the weekend edition of the Daily Stoic. Each weekday, we bring you a meditation inspired by the ancient Stoics, something to help you live up to those four Stoic virtues of courage, justice, temperance, and wisdom. And then here on the weekend, we take a deeper dive into those same topics. We interview Stoic philosophers. We explore at length how these Stoic ideas can be applied to our actual lives and the challenging issues of our time. Here on the weekend, when you have a little bit more space, when things have slowed down, be sure to take some time to think, to go for a walk, to sit with your journal, and most importantly, to prepare for what the week ahead may bring.
There's a lot of things we know would be good for us. Problem is, we don't have time. It's just tougher. I think therapy is like that. We all know that sitting down, talking to someone, really working on our issues will make a difference. So the problem is finding a therapist, driving across town, all of that, right? And that's where Talkspace comes in, today's sponsor. Because by doing everything online, Talkspace has made getting the help you want easier, more accessible, and more affordable. With Talkspace, you can sign up online and get a personalized match with a provider that's right for you, typically within 48 hours. You can have virtual sessions with your licensed therapist from the comfort of your home. And Talkspace is secure and private, using the latest end-to-end grade encryption to store client information and complying with the latest HIPAA regulations. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $80 off your first month with Talkspace when you go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter code SPACE80. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter promo code SPACE80, that's 80, to get $80 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's Talkspace.com/stoic, promo code SPACE80.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. We push what technology can do so great ideas can happen now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now. Hey, it's Ryan. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Stoic Podcast. The unexpected, strange, surreal perk of writing these books about ancient philosophy has been their resonance in professional athletics. Not something I expected, not something I anticipated, but as a sports fan, as a amateur endurance athlete myself, it's just been a total joy. And I think the Stoics would have appreciated that. And Marcus Aurelius clearly was familiar with boxing and wrestling, Epictetus as well. Chrysippus was a runner. Cleanthes was himself a boxer. So I think the sports world and the Stoic world was, in the ancient world, much more intertwined than we would associate philosophy and physical activity today. And it's just been so awesome to see athletes with this sort of philosophical practice. But I also just love talking to people who are best in the world at what they do, how they think about craft, how they think about ambition, how they think about balance, how they think about winning and losing. These are just things I love talking about. Talked to a lot of athletes this year and last year. And so in today's compilation interview, we've got some awesome interviews. We're going to be talking to Chris Bosh, two-time NBA champion, 11-time All-Star, Olympic gold medalist on the pursuit of greatness. We're talking about Los Angeles Rams GM, Les Snead, about keeping the main thing the main thing. We're going to be talking to Major League Baseball pitcher Scott Oberg on overcoming adversity, which he has had to experience in a very difficult career that's been ravaged by injuries as of late. We're going to talk to swimming coach Bob Bowman, the guy behind Michael Phelps, on balancing stillness and excellence. And then I was also lucky enough to talk to USA Olympic gold medalist Dominique Dawes. Finally, we have NASCAR champion Brad Keselowski on reaching your maximum potential. And here is my interview with Chris Bosh. If you haven't read the book that he and I collaborated on, Letters to a Young Athlete, you can click that in the links below. To me, the definition of Stoicism is that you don't control what happens, you control how you respond. Yeah. And that's what you have to do as an athlete. That's what you have to do as a parent. That's what we had to do the last year in the pandemic, which is like, how do I figure out how to make the best of it? Because you can't quit.
Quitting is not an option. That's one of the sayings I like to say is that, you know, failure is not trying.
Yes. Me.
You know, not even trying, just saying, you know, whatever excuse you give yourself not to try. Anything you go after, you're going to take some lumps. You're going to take some punches. You're going to get knocked down, you know. And I didn't understand that, at least for me, until, you know, losing in Dallas in 2011, which was crazy. It's 10 years ago almost to the date. And, you know, I watch Michael Jordan and Kobe Bryant every year. They make it to the finals all the time and they win.
Yeah.
You know, so when you get to a point where, you know, you think you have some immunity because of whatever accolades you've racked up in the past or because you're a professional basketball player on this level, when we lost, it really clicked in for me and just said, wow, okay. Because sure, I was dealing with things off the court as a person. You feel that's not fair.
Right.
And then all these other things are happening and that's not fair. At least we could win, right? This dumb championship. And then we lose it. And it's like,
How devastating is that?
It's like a loss in the family. You know, it's like it's a sudden loss, you know, and especially when you put yourself in a state of mind of visualizing yourself doing it for months and months and months, you know. And then for me, it was especially tough. It's my hometown team. We're playing the Mavericks. I'm watching my ex-classmates wear Mavericks jerseys and shirts. They didn't watch that stuff. Nobody wore Mavericks stuff back in the day. Now everybody's, right, you know, rocking the championship gear. It was just, you know, it was devastating, but it made me realize how I understood right away of, you know, Jason Kidd, Dirk Nowitzki, Jason Terry, those guys went through pain losing back in 2006, Jason Kidd back in 2003 and again in 2004, you know, it's just, or in 2001, 2002.
But imagine how devastated Jason Terry would have been because he got that tattoo, remember? He got the in advance.
Hey, man, hey. But, you know, and I learned something from that, too. I remember that because I remember looking at it like, oh, who do these guys think they are? Hey, man, you got to get it tatted on you sometimes. It's like failure is not an option. And understanding that, I understood after pretty much just coming up short and kind of having that pie in the face moment. And you know, knowing that I have to rebuild from that and you know, hopefully get back to that level the next year, but accept, you know, whatever consequence comes.
Yeah, I was talking to Manu Ginobili, and he was telling me that, like, the pivotal moment for him was going up for that rebound with you. He said, he told me that he should have fouled you, is what he said.
Yeah.
But he was saying, you know, so he goes up for that, you know, they end up losing the series and he comes home and he's like, I've never been more unhappy in my life.
They had never lost.
Yeah.
Never lost.
And what he was saying though, is what struck him was he was like, I'm living my dream. I'm one of the best people in the world at what I do. Mm-hmm. I gave my absolute best. If I'm not having fun, enjoying myself while I'm doing it, like, I'm going to regret it forever. So did you come out of losing with a better appreciation for the game and for win? Like, cause you know, you quote Kipling in the book, you know, like, to treat winning and losing as the right, same imposters,
the
you know, were you able to come out of that a little bit closer
after the loss?
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I hate the term losing builds character, but it kind of does. You just don't want to make it a habit. You know, you just don't want to make it a habit. But having those...
Yeah, show me a good loser and I'll show you a loser.
You know what I mean? So just like in that context, you think about the things that you could have done better. You think about maybe that day off where you're like, let me just kind of coast today, or that moment, even if it was just for a minute, that you kind of lost focus in what you do. And that time where you say, man, I should have been having a little more. I should have been enjoying myself a little more because we lost anyway, you know. Right. At least could have had a good time, you know. There's a fine balance in both. And I think for me, my personal journey with that was just understanding that it could happen to you. Understanding that, just because of the level you're at doesn't make you impervious to these things. You're human.
Yeah.
You're going to have to go through this process. And sometimes you're just going to get knocked, going to get beat up.
You know,
what are you going to, like you say, how are you going to react? How are you going to be the one to, challenge the way that you think in getting better after this? Are you going to get better? Or are you just going to kind of sit around and complain? Because after a while, that's only going to get you so far eventually, which for most of us was right away. But I got back on the horse and got to a point to say, man, I'm not going to let it beat me next time.
There's some ego in it too, right? There's this quote I love. It's the first sign of an impending nervous collapse is the belief that your work is terribly, terribly important. And it's like, what you do is important. I care so much about my books, but then, one of the things that's great about having kids is they don't care at all. It's nothing to them. You might as well be an insurance salesman, and it helps put it in perspective, which is that it's important and excellence is important. And as you said, you don't want to make losing a habit. At the same time, if you think that it's a matter of life and death, it's probably actually a bad strategy over the long term.
Yeah. You don't want to fight or flight is there for a reason, right?
Yeah.
You want to fight or fly. If you're having those feelings and you're not fighting or flighting, I don't understand, and it's especially if we're putting, sometimes you can't help it.
Yeah.
You're going to have your reaction. But if you're putting in, like you say, those life or death situations, I've known people and I've done that for myself as well.
Yeah.
It's life or death. This game is, sometimes you use it to kind of psych yourself out. But yeah, after a while, you've got to be loose.
Yeah.
You have to have a flow to things. You just can't be rigid. That was one of the things I learned playing the game too. In losing that series against Dallas, we were just so uptight.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, man, just too tight. Nothing was loose. We weren't trusting the work that we had put in up until that point. And we were just kind of beside ourselves a little bit and not concentrating on playing. We were concentrating on mistakes or making it life or death. Or saying, oh my God, we lost a game. Yeah. Okay, we got to win the next one then.
Golf is a good metaphor, I think, in that, the harder you try, the worse you are at it. You still have to be good. You still have to train, you still have to know your fundamentals. But in Buddhism, they talk about willful will. Mm-hmm. If you have too much willful will, if you're trying to force it too much, that's when you...
Yeah.
And you mentioned sort of tight, loose. That's what a trainer wants you to be. They want you to be loose. If you're tight, that's when you hurt yourself.
Yeah, for sure. That's when you hurt yourself. That's when you start pulling stuff. And in playing for different coaches, the greater coaches, they emphasize being loose, as a team. you might do something instead of practice today. Let's watch a movie.
Yeah.
Let's watch He Got Game or something like that, and let's discuss it. Or let's do things to make sure that we're loose, we're good. Let's not be in this tension of life or death for the whole time because, we're human beings. We pick up on those things pretty good. And if it's like that collectively as a group, if everybody's tight, then, it's really not going to work.
I think that's for instance, the unfair advantage that Tom Brady has, right? He's been there so many times. He can be when you watch him when he's up against, a Jared Goff, who's the first time he's been in the Super Bowl, by definition, who's looser? The guy who's been there a dozen times, the guy who's not only been in the Super Bowl, but been down by 25 points in the 100%. Super Bowl. You can be chill because you're, you and I have talked about this where it's the difference between ego and confidence. Confidence is loose. Ego is my identity is riding on this.
Right.
Everything.
Right.
But confidence is I've been here before.
Yeah. Hey, I've been here before. Remember that time we discussed if we're down 25 at halftime.
Yeah.
this now is the time to implement those things. Good thing that we've talked about this, because these are the packages we need to run.
Yes.
And I mean, even if I'm in Jared Goff's situation, being a young quarterback, getting to the Super Bowl, you know, Goff, Tom Brady, oh my goodness, you can get into all that stuff. I found that game fascinating because Tom knew, like, okay, we're just going to grind these guys into the ground. We're going to make it close because I know they're a little tight.
Yeah.
If it's a third and four and they're down three, they're going to feel a little bit, you know, different because they're used to their offense running at a certain level.
Right.
And if it's not running at that level, they're going to, you know, they're going to feel it a little bit. So, you know, it's just kind of, you got to train, man. You have to identify what those things that, you know, first what you want to do and then work backwards from there and say, okay, hey, I want to be a really good basketball player, or we want to win a championship as this team. All right, cool. These are the things that we need to do. We've got to communicate good. We've got to make sure we're practicing and putting the work in every day. And we have to make sure that we're together and we know our stuff. So when it hits the fan, because it will.
Yeah.
When, you know, we stay together, you know, and make sure we're, you know, doing the things that we always practice.
And here's me talking to Los Angeles Rams GM Les Snead. So when I came out and talked to you guys, I guess it was 2 years ago now or three, I forget. But one of the things you had showed me that was sort of in the Rams cultural values was keep the main thing the main thing. What does that mean? And how do you guys sort of actually apply that?
So really simply, I think what I would say, let's call it the one variable that, or the first variable is, all right, we have an organization made up of a lot of different people, and within that, each one of these individuals has an expertise, and some of those individuals are leading other experts in kind of their realm or that group's expertise. And some of the people in those groups are trying to become experts and may have other roles that help the experts. But so number one would be the first variable was, if we all come into the building and try to help the Rams improve at football, at whatever your job description is.
Sure.
Spend our energy there, right? So what that leads to, what we're hoping is, right, some version of some compound interest, a Jim Collins flywheel effect, a snowball effect where, right, we just keep rolling the snow and the ball gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And it's because we're focused on that snowball. Right. So that's number one. The other two is I think it can cut down on some of the people interaction, collaboration, drama, right? In terms of that, I think hinders production is, okay, sure. Wait a minute. That's not the main thing, right? Whether one person likes this color and the other person likes that color. One person voted for this politician, the other. That's okay. That's not the main thing here. Let's get back to making Rams football better. So that's probably the, and I can't go this, and you're going to ask a question in the entertainment business, because our product is really, we're creating it for the public.
Yeah.
And the neat thing is what keeps, it's called entertainment rolling and professional sports rolling. It is maybe the drama that takes place in between the games.
Sure.
And there is an element, right, of there's going to be a lot of noise on the outside.
Sure.
Right? Critics, what have you, ideas, but that's not the main thing. The main thing is to create a product so that our fans can discuss it, whether they thumbs up it or thumbs down it. That's, we have to stay focused on the main thing, and the main thing is
winning.
Make Rams football. Well, it's really, I think, it's not necessarily winning. That would be the result. I think what we can control is dominating our role and trying to make Rams football better. And that's a little bit easier to control. It's a little bit easier to build a task list and, hey, let's go win a game. What we're hoping, Ryan, is all of that combines that on Sunday when the clock, you know, runs out and there's zero, zero, zeros on the clock, you know, we have more points than the other team. But
so does it, is it like that the organization has the main thing of like get better at football, and then does each subsequent person have their own main thing? Like the GM yeah. has a main thing, the coach has a main thing, the running back has a main thing, the janitor has a main thing. And that's sort of where the Belichick idea of like, just do your job comes in.
Do your job, be clear and concise on what that job is, right? And stealing a little bit from James Clear and some of his habit journal stuff, right? The and he talks about the 80-20 rule, right? It's making sure everyone in the building, right, has those 1 to 2 to 3 to 4 things that they can dominate, that they actually can manage enough time and intensely focus on that and dominate. And again, that gets back to your first question now, right? Is everyone has a specific role. They know that role. They understand that role. That should allow them to not have to be at the office at 4 a.m. and leave at 11. And it can also help individuals determine, wait a minute, this isn't a role that truly fulfills me, so maybe I better go look somewhere else.
Right. It must be weird for the GM because you have so much control, but then you also have so little control. Like, you can assemble the players, you can negotiate their contracts, you can set up incentives, but at the end of the day, like, you can't actually throw or catch the football for them, and you can't decide what plays get called. So is that a challenge too? Like, how does each person in the organization stay in their lane?
That is the humbling part of sports, probably a humbling part of a lot of life, but it is maybe the more fulfilling part of sports, is right where there is a collection of humans, and we're collaborating to compete, right? We're collaborating not necessarily to be the best GM or be the best offensive line coach or be the best athletic trainer or be the best team chaplain or be the best team psychologist. We're all collectively collaborating for the Rams to be greater. And that whole Rams is greater than all of us. So both humbling and
frustrating,
and fulfilling. Yeah. Humbling, frustrating, and fulfilling at the same time.
Yeah. Because not all,
Hey Ryan, can I check out and go close the door real quick?
Of course.
Can you hear the construction?
A little bit. Much better.
Yeah, one of those things you can't control, right? We have training camp in Irvine, and our hotel is going under full-blown construction. But during COVID or times, it is. Right, the obstacle is the way, or the rose or the thorn is. There's only us really at this hotel.
Oh, so nice.
We're right. Not sharing it.
I remember when I wrote "Ego is the Enemy," there was this exchange between John Snyder and Pete Carroll. Someone was asking them. They said, "You know, how have you guys worked together for so long? Most GMs and coaches don't have long-term collaborative relationships. It tends to be short-term or collaborative or worse. They hate each other." And John Snyder said something like, "Ego is the enemy," meaning that the two of them were able to collaborate because they took ego out of it. How does that relationship work? Not just between you and Sean, but how does it work generally? Because I imagine there is some jockeying for power and control, but the only way you're both going to be successful is if you're able to collaborate with each other.
Yes. And going back to the main thing, if your main thing as a general manager or head coach is to, right, gain more power or control within your organization, that doesn't necessarily help you on Sundays.
Sure.
Now, maybe the reason one of the two is trying because they actually think that, but the energy spent trying to gain that extra power control probably somewhere along the way dilutes what they're really experts at. And then going back to that, right, both a general manager, head coach, and anyone in this building, right, we probably have different superpowers, different expertises, and there's an element, right, where you definitely have to respect and then trust that the other can do, you know, and be useful and dominate their responsibility. So I think that is very key. And that's what really works between Sean and myself is he really wants to coach football. And I would not be any good at coaching football. And he doesn't want to do my job.
Right.
He might be good at my job, but he doesn't want to do it. And I think we both, right, that allowing each other to do their job, that allows us to really focus on what we're experts at. And at the end of the day, that truly helps when we do sit down to solve problems, overcome obstacles collectively, collaboratively, right, to figure out the best solution or the better innovation and things like that.
I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorne sponsored today's episode. Thorne takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorne, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorne. Go to thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorne.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. The Daily Stoic is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. One of the cool things about podcasts is that you can multitask while you're listening, but depending on what you're doing right now, like for instance, if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you could be doing. You could be getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $698 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
And here's me talking to Major League Baseball pitcher Scott Hoberg. I find when I'm going through crap or I'm really sort of difficult, I'm consumed with my own thoughts or anxiety or frustrations or troubles, when you focus on somebody else, not only do you forget about your problems for a while, but you may end up opening up a new door or opportunity or way of thinking about your own problems that does in fact help you.
Yeah, I think so. I think in a roundabout way, I think it does, you know, kind of ease the suffering a little bit. And, you know, I think the best, you know, I've heard this before too, you know, the best way to, you know, to make sure that you understand certain material or certain, you know, principles or foundations or whatever it may be is to be able to articulate it to somebody else so that they can understand what it is that you're talking about. And I've, you know, find myself, yes, you know, I've been in the past, I've always been intentional about trying to teach even younger kids, you know, give pitching lessons or whatnot. And hearing myself say the things that I believe in kind of reinforces why I believe them or why I think that they're important.
Yes, that's right. Well, Seneca says, you know, we learn as we teach, which I think is true. But I also find you know, when I was writing The Obstacles Away, I looked at this set of studies about elite athletes. I think they were in Canada, and they were talking about post-traumatic growth versus post-traumatic injury or disorder, right? And they were saying that oftentimes the athlete may come back from the injury weaker in some way because they blew out their knee or they don't have quite the same mobility or whatever it is, they put on weight, but they're better because they've spent that time studying the game. They understand, you know, their role in the game. They appreciate their teammates more. Maybe they're more connected to, like, I got to imagine, let's say you come back at 100% in a year, you know, next season. Not only did you help your teammates through, you know, you contributed to your teammates, but the team will be, you will be coming back to a stronger team where the players are more connected with each other because of this period. And so again, that's the idea of the obstacle being the way.
Sure. Yeah, no, without a doubt. And I think, you know, you just said, like, in a very, to me, like, you know, when you mentioned appreciation, you know, I think that that's one of the things that when the game or, you know, when life kind of puts you on the sidelines for a little bit, you know, the things that you were really involved in, the things that you really enjoyed doing, you know, when you can't do them anymore, you kind of have that greater appreciation because now you can see it, you know, from a bird's eye view or from the sidelines or, you know, whatever metaphor you want to apply to it. But, you know, you really get that deep appreciation for, you know, how much you enjoy it, how much sure. you see other people being successful at it. And, you know, I think that there's like an inner drive too, to be, you know, especially at times where I've had to go through some sort of a rehab process, whether it was with, you know, surgeries or, you know, whatever else is, you know, you have the game taken away from you for a small period of time. And, you know, I'm watching it on TV, or I'm watching in the dugout or what have you. And it motivates me to want to get back out there. So the things that I'm going to do with the training staff or physical therapists or whatever it may be, you know, like you said, there might be some physical atrophy in the muscles, but, you know, mentally I might be stronger. I might be better because I know I've gone through the process and I've gone through all the steps to get back to ultimately where I want to get to. And I think that's where that appreciation comes in. And that's where it becomes maybe a little bit more digestible to overcome those obstacles on a daily basis when, you know, like we were saying earlier, you know, you just don't, sometimes you just don't feel like doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. So you mentioned earlier the idea of pitchers and thrower, or pitchers versus throwers. And I was thinking about this when I was writing Stillness, my book Stillness is the Key, which is probably the book I talk about baseball the most. I was talking about this idea that, and I didn't come up with it, but it's a pretty well-established fact, as you all know, that like sort of hitting a baseball is the single hardest act in professional sports, right? But part of the reason it's so hard is because people like you are on the other side, right? You're trying to make it as hard as possible. So I'm interested in this idea. You were saying that, you know, perhaps as you're physically declining in one sense, you're also getting more strategic, more clever, better able to disguise your pitches, better able to, you know, get in the head of the batter. Is that sort of how you've seen your career arc, not just as a human being who spent time in the league, but also as you've been battling these sort of physical obstacles that they've forced you to get better mentally?
Damn it.
You dropped off for a sec, but did you hear me?
I heard up until a couple seconds ago, if you were just starting to get into,
I'll go again.
The mound and okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So in Stillness is the Key, I probably my book I talk the most about baseball, but I was referencing this idea, which I'm sure you've heard a million times, that hitting a pitch in baseball is the hardest act in professional sports. But the reason it's hard is because guys like you are on the other side, right? You're trying to make it hard. Mm-hmm. And I was curious, you're talking about pitchers versus throwers. Have you seen your arc as you've gone on, as you've gotten older, dealt with these physical things, that you've had to get more strategic, more clever, you know, play the psychological game as a pitcher? Is that sort of how you've seen yourself developing?
Yeah, without a doubt. You know, it's even just on the baseball side, outside of the medical, you know, it's been its own transition, its own transformation where, you know, younger in my career, you know, I sped through the minor leagues a little bit quicker than what is the norm, I guess. I think I was up there within 3 years of being drafted, especially for somebody that wasn't a very particularly high draft pick. It kind of breaks the norm a little bit. And so I got up there and I was throwing very hard, but my command wasn't great. My off-speed pitches, you know, they had great movement to it, but they weren't very effective because they weren't landing in the spots that they needed to get to. And the first 4 years of my career, I was bouncing back and forth between AAA and the big league level because I wasn't throwing enough strikes. I was walking too many batters. You know, the scouting report was, hey, you know, this guy's probably going to throw four balls before he throws three strikes, so wait him out a little bit. And then the times where I would fall behind in a count, now I have to be back in the zone, and that's where the damage would get done. I'd give up a lot of doubles, a lot of home runs. You know, and you go through those growing pains as an athlete on the field. And that was really like the first major time, extended period of time where I really failed athletically. So that's kind of almost like its own unique shock to the system, you know, because I think as athletes, especially guys that get to the levels they get to, you know, more times than not, they're not really as challenged as much as they probably could be until they get to the top level. And at that point, you know, sometimes you have to take a look at the mirror and maybe change some things around. So I ended up dropping some pitches that had made me successful over the years. You know, I had been a two seam fastball and a curveball type of pitcher when I got up to the big leagues. And then what ended up making me successful was a four seam fastball and a slider. So it was almost as if, you know, I'm two different pitchers. I mean, even the times where I would watch video for myself I would almost disregard my first couple of years because, you know, it's like watching a completely different person, a completely different pitcher. I don't, you know, I'm not going to be able to learn anything from that pitcher, at least on within the game itself, from a standpoint like that, where, you know, if I'm trying to pick something up or, you know, how should I attack certain hitters, you know, the pitcher that I was in 2018, 2019 was vastly different from the pitcher I was in 2015, 2016, where I was throwing hard, but I had no clue where it was going. I was a thrower, so to speak. And, you know, I had to learn how to be a pitcher in AAA. And the last time that I got sent back down was in 2018. You know, I had come off a playoff experience in 2017. I thought I had kind of righted the ship a little bit. And I opened up the season in April, and I was not very good. So I had to go back down to Albuquerque and readjust some things. But when I came back up, I had made all of the right adjustments. I had really put all of my focus into what it was that I was trying to do, because I knew I had, you know, the stuff. I had the movement of the pitches. I had, you know, some elite velocity on my fastball. And at that point, it was just a matter of really tightening everything up, narrowing the focus, getting to a point where I can be consistent with the locations of my pitches. And I think the difference between the pitchers and the throwers are that the pitchers can really command the fastball on both sides of the plate pretty much whenever they want to. And, you know, we were talking about LaTroy Hawkins earlier. And I mean, one of the first things I ever asked him was, I said, Hawk, what's made you successful? Why, you know, what is it about you that has been able to play 18, 19, 20 years at the major league level, not just professional baseball?
Right.
And he's like, one, he's like, your body's a race car and you got to fuel it like one. And number two, he's like, he took a home plate and he took both of his hands and he just kind of went back and forth on the corners. And he's like, you got to live on the corners in this league.
What does that mean?
He's like, basically you got to put your fastball on both sides of the plate. You got to be able to throw in the corners. He's like, you can't catch too much of the plate.
Interesting.
So he was really able to just go in and out, left on both sides of the plate, lefties and righties, put his fastball really where he wanted to. And it took a little bit of time to figure that out and to get that. But once it did, it clicked. And, you know, I went from a guy that was probably, you know, one of the worst relievers in the league to now I'm right up there with some of the best relievers in the league. And to me, it was just, you know, really establishing the fastball command and learning how to pitch.
Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to affordable sexual health treatments from the comfort of your couch. It's always sensitive talking about these things, but Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to doctor-trusted ED treatments such as chewable hard mints, brand name treatments like Viagra, or generic alternatives for up to 95% cheaper. The process is simple and 100% online. No uncomfortable doctor's visits. If prescribed, your medication ships to you for free. No insurance needed. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/TDS. That's hims.com/TDS for your personalized ED treatment options. Hard mints are a chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with your healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. I talk about that in Growth Hacker Marketing. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/stoic. That's netsuite.com/stoic.
Here's me talking to Bob Bowman. Well, in a way that that requires, like, clearly you're not Michael Phelps or Katie Ledecky or Simone Manuel without an incredible amount of self-discipline, or yes, Tiger Woods or Michael Jordan or whomever. But it's almost as if the highest level of self-discipline is, how do you discipline your self-discipline, right? Like, yeah, how do you say, just because this is the direction, trajectory we're going, doesn't mean we're going to continue. We're actually going to stop. We're going to scale back. We're going to pivot slightly. We're going to do this intentionally, as opposed to just letting the momentum and the expectations of everyone else determine what and how we do things.
Exactly. And after we did get to that point, it just took 2 years.
Right.
And by the time we did that, that affected his London performances for sure. Although I thought he did a credible job based on kind of how he had prepared. But what I decided, I'll tell you how I got to that, we got out of it, was I was at a breaking point too. Like, you know, Michael was doing things like not coming to practice for 2 weeks, right?
Yeah.
He never missed a practice in 12 years, right? You know, yeah, it was like, okay. And that was sort of our hallmark, right? We're here, we're invested, we're doing all this stuff nobody else is doing, and that's what makes us great. So instead of kind of, you know, understanding what he was going through, I just doubled down on the, you know, you're throwing your career away, you're letting everybody down. You know, I did everything you could do that was stupid in that part. And finally, our agent, Peter Carlisle, who's such a tremendous resource for both of us, I was talking with him about it. I was frustrated. Michael wasn't coming to practice, and he wasn't going to be able to do this. And this meet was coming up, and we needed to do this, but we didn't do it. So it was, might as well just not even go, and all this kind of stuff. And he said two things. He's like, I'm going to give you a book, Eckhart Tolle, The Power of Now. And he sent it to me. And I would suggest that in this circumstance, how about we just let everything go, except for when Michael comes into practice, you give him the best practice you can give him on that day and leave it at that. You know, be present, right?
Yeah.
Just focus on the present, not what didn't happen, not what's going to happen. And when I started doing that, the practices weren't too bad. And he kept coming back. So that's kind of how we got out of it. But it just, and of course I read The Power Now. I've probably read it 7 or 8 times now. And that really changed my outlook on how to deal with a lot of things, not only just in swimming, but in my life. And I just think that was a very powerful learning thing for both of us. And Michael's read that book a couple times now. And we both sort of rely on it.
Well, that strikes me as a very sort of Phil Jackson approach of like this sort of jujitsu zen approach to like, don't try to force it. You're not going to get this from a top-down way. How do you sort of strip things down to their essence? Think about what this specific person needs in this specific instance. And that usually, yeah, letting go and being present gets you there better than force or, as they say, sort of willful will.
Exactly. And, you know, I think when I started coaching, just because of the coaches that coached me and kind of the environment of sports when I was, you know, in the 80s, when I was kind of really doing it, I got into it, and it's the classic example of when all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
Yes.
And you get very good results with that quickly, right? But what you find is over time, you just create so many more problems than you solve by doing that. And you kind of hope that you'll get the result at the end of the season and everybody's kind of bought in again to do it again. And then you kind of double down on the, I can be, make you do this. Right. But that's just no way to have sustained success. It's not a really way to teach people what to do. And I feel like as a coach, that is my biggest growth area, is that I've gotten away from that kind of what the coach says goes, and you do this too. Here's what we're going to do. Here's our plan. Buy into it. I'll push you for sure. And I'll let you know if you're not kind of doing what you said you wanted to do. But I just feel like the whole mindset of what we do is different now. And that's a very good thing.
Yeah, that was what was, I think, most striking to me. And I think most missed about what Simone Biles did during the Olympics was it wasn't even a coach. It was, she noticed it in herself that she wasn't where she needed to be. And she had the discipline. And I would say the courage and the confidence to be like, no, this isn't right. I'm going to adjust in the following way. When there must have been, I mean, just think of the financial pressure, the cultural pressure, the teammate pressure, the coach pressure, all of that pressure, she was able to somehow have the self-awareness and the sense of self to make a decision that clearly must have violated every core of like the athlete's commitment to the game as well.
Exactly. It was an amazing thing to just witness and see how it took place over the period of those games. And I was very impressed with her and just her self-awareness, I guess, is the word, right? You know yourself, you know what you're capable of. Obviously, we know she's capable of doing amazing things, but just to be able to do that in that environment was really impressive.
And to me, what's actually most impressive is like, if she had just said like, I'm not feeling it, because I think we've all done this. Any person that also has some like leverage in their career knows this. It's why celebrities throw like tantrums and storm off. You're like, I'm not feeling it, I'm out. Right? Which is often rooted in actually a kind of self-awareness, but you don't have the self-control or the discipline to explain yourself to, like, she could have just said, like, she could have just flown home, right?
Like, yeah, for sure.
And it would have been also a controversy, but there would have been like no consequence. She could have just left. What I found so impressive is that she stayed and she competed. So it wasn't even like an all or nothing thing. I mean, she still won a bronze medal. So you're like, she was able to have not just like the vague sense of awareness that some of us have where we're like, something's not right. I don't want to force it. She was able to dial in specifically to what she could and couldn't do, compartmentalize it enough to do the thing that she could do at such a high level that she was the third best in the entire world, you know, in that brief moment, even despite all the controversy, distraction, attention, and focus.
Exactly. Yeah.
So The Power of Now hit you. Have there been some other books that have been influential for you as a coach?
Yeah, all of yours. I've read all of them. And that's just not because I'm on here. That's the truth.
I love that.
I've The Daily Stoic, you know, I gave it to Michael.
Oh, wow.
He reads it. Yeah, I give it. That's probably the one I give out as a gift most often. And I'm
next
on
time
my,
you're giving it away, yeah. Tell me and I'll send the leather ones for you.
Oh, that would be awesome. That would be beautiful. I think I'm on my third time through it.
Oh, wow.
You know, I read it every day regardless. Like when I went to the Olympics, I took it with me. So every day, the first thing I do in the morning is read that day's passage. So it has a big impact, impact on me. And I like it because it's small enough that it doesn't take a lot of time to read, yeah. But it can have a big impact. And then I try to have a cup of coffee and just sort of reflect on it before I start my day. So that's the first thing I do every day.
What other books have worked for you? Like what other books do you pass to athletes?
Power of Now is a big one. A New Earth, right? You know, same kind of thing. To athletes, I try to keep it. You know, I like Stillness is the Key. Was the one I've given out the most.
Oh, wow.
Because I think it's easily accessible to them. And I think it teaches them a lot about how to be. I think in their worlds today, there's just so much noise, right?
Sure.
And so much iPhone and constant stimulation. And to be able to get yourself out of that, I think is one of the most important skills they can learn.
I read a daily book that you might like called A Calendar of Wisdom by Leo Tolstoy. He, you know, of A War and Peace and all his famous books, but he collected like what he thought were his favorite quotes or ideas. Sometimes they're Bible passages, sometimes they're passages from the Stoics. It's not it's a little less like put together. It's not like quote story or something, but I love to flip through that every day. And it's part of my morning routine. I think
that's
might
a cool
it.
One. And what's the name?
It's called A Calendar of Wisdom.
A Calendar of Wisdom. I will definitely get it.
Do you see that as part? I think people sometimes think that, and I know obviously we've just disproven it because we've talked about it so much, but I have been amazed at just what a big focus sort of personal development, reading, philosophy even has been in athletics. Not just with coaches, but with athletes, and actually what a bond it is between athletes and coaches. Like I did this book, Letters to a Young Athlete with Chris Bosch, and he was talking about like almost all his favorite books were given to him by a coach at one point or another because they addressed like a very specific issue or part of his game or personality that he was working on.
Yeah. No, I try to use that more and more now, particularly with college age athletes. I think it's a great thing. And you know, I was trying to go some. Oh, I did all the Mickey Singer books. You ever read those? The Surrender.
No, I never even heard of them.
Oh well, the Surrender Experiment, The Untethered Soul.
Oh, I know that one. Yeah,
you know that's like was Oprah's favorite book of whatever some year. But it's more Eckhart Tolle type stuff. It's based on some Buddhist. You know, he is. Was Buddhist, but it's an amazing story, his personal life. And I've actually shared that with some athletes because it just lets you think about your life in a lot of different ways. One of the things that I kind of try to think about with myself when I'm trying to be philosophical is that, you know, you want to be in alignment, right? And I don't want to get too religious or anything else, but like if you're in alignment with the source, right?
Sure.
You're making the right decisions. You know, you're doing making stoic decisions, right? You want to do the right thing first before everything else.
Sure.
And a lot of times trying to get to that, I feel like just surrendering and letting it happen and letting it go, that's when your life starts to flow. When you try to resist a lot of things that happen to you in life, they persist, right? Whatever you resist persists. So I'm trying to teach my kids that, you know, the less resistance you put up to things, the easier you solve problems and the more flow you have in your life. And I think these books teach that.
For the last 2 years, we've been doing this thing that we call the Daily Stoic New Year, New You Challenge. It's 21 actionable challenges, one per day, built around the best Stoic wisdom, but for what? How to be better in the new year. This is the time when we start to think about what we're going to do next, where all the time went, what we wish had gone differently or better, how we're still struggling with this or that, how we'd like to stop doing this or that. And that's what the New Year, New You challenge is all about. It's my favorite thing that we do, and it's 3 weeks of actionable challenges presented in one email per day, built around the best, most timeless wisdom in Stoic philosophy. It should help you snap out of this trance we've all found ourselves in and help make 2022 your best year yet, no matter what's happening in the world around you. Go to dailystoic.com/challenge to join us. I'd love to have you. I'm challenging you to join me. I can't wait to see you. dailystoic.com/challenge. Here's me talking to Dominique Dawes, one of the best there ever was. I read something from Billie Jean King once where she was sort of saying the paradox of being a great athlete. I'd be curious about your experiences. Is that precisely the perfectionism, the focus on what could have been better, where you fell short, you know, what went wrong, is what makes you great. It obviously creates a feedback loop where you are getting better, but it also makes it extraordinarily difficult to enjoy or even notice that you are at the peak of your game or that you've accomplished an incredible amount. Like you're not able to enjoy the peak because all you're focusing on is the next peak or how imperfectly you got there.
Exactly. Like what you didn't accomplish. Like it's never enough. I mean, there was just this great piece on HBO, and it was talking about the mental aspect of the sport of gymnastics and how many Olympians are just never satisfied. And then when even their career is over, there's that coulda, woulda, shoulda. There's that what's next, because their identity is wrapped up in being that particular athlete and nothing more, because you sacrifice so much, especially if you did it since your childhood. So it is hard to kind of, you know, I guess be satisfied, but that's what makes, I think, a lot of athletes so great, that they have that, like you mentioned before, that drive to always want to do more and be better.
Yeah, and especially if you came from a place in your childhood where maybe you didn't fully feel enough, or you felt like, hey, you know, it's like when I'm succeeding at this, this is when, you know, I feel like my parents are proud of me, or I feel like I'm more accepted. We can pick up all these like super complicated issues that kind of get intertwined with winning or success or money or fame. And then I think the saddest, hardest part is you finally get everything that you think you wanted and it didn't do what you hoped. So it's encouraging to me to hear you talk about the family stuff, because that is the one element for me that turned out to be even better than I thought. Do you know what I mean? Like hitting number one was great, but anticlimactic. You know, I've never felt like any experiences with my family were anticlimactic. My wedding was not anticlimactic. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, you know, waking up in the middle of the night, hearing a screaming baby at 2 a.m., not the most joyful, experience in life, but it's very fulfilling. And I know I'll miss those days. And I really don't miss being at the Olympics. You know, I don't reminisce.
Really?
And I don't reminisce and miss, oh, that feeling that I got in 1996 standing on the podium, which I was very honored to be a part of that and honored to have such amazing teammates and, you know, to win a gold medal and make history. But when I dream about, you know, exciting moments and memories in my life, those don't come up. They really don't. It's the time, you know, with my spouse, or, you know, making that commitment to say I do, because I never thought I would get married coming from a divorced household and seeing so much heartache and pain there, or, you know, birthing two children naturally and then birthing twins, you know, like, wow, that was just, you know, a miracle and amazing. But people do it all the time. Like they do it every day. But it was, those are the moments that I really relish, and they make me smile and they're fulfilling for me. And then the moments today of a young kid walking through my door smiling, or the stories that I've heard of parents that had their kids in gymnastics, they had a negative experience. They were in a very unhealthy environment, too much pressure, a lot of negativity. They get into our classes here, they have a blast, and they're smiling, and they can't wait to come back. That's fulfilling. I'm not saying that the Olympics doesn't matter to me. It definitely did, but that's not what, you know, that's not what fulfills me, and that's not what makes me whole. And it was a little difficult, I will say, as a young athlete, winning gold, standing on top of the podium and being like, oh, this is it. Like, I'm not fulfilled. What just happened here? This is what. And then when I reached investing and putting away over $1 million, I was like, oh, wait, I'm supposed to feel so much better about myself and so great, but I don't. And so it's those moments with your family. It's those moments with your spouse. It's those moments knowing that you've planted an amazing positive seed in a stranger's life, that those are the moments, you know, that fulfill us and that'll last with us for a lifetime.
Yeah, I remember when my book hit number one for the first time, I was mowing the lawn.
Yeah.
And, you know, the text came in and it's like, I still have to finish mowing this lawn. And it was this thing, you know, it was like a 5-year thing in the making, and it had been this, and I expected to feel X, and I felt sort of the lack of X.
Yep.
And then when I think about like the best moments of my life, you know, it's like sitting on a porch swing with one of my kids and they say something cute, or, you know, it's weird how the actual ordinary things are actually what you find to be extraordinary, and the extraordinary things, as great as they are and as much as they facilitate, you know, you couldn't have gotten $1 million without winning the Olympics, and you couldn't open the gym without but it's how little we actually need to be happy. And yet we spend, unfortunately, people spend so much of their time. Like, so some people feel that, I guess I'd be curious what you think. So they get on the medal stand, or they hit number one, and it's anticlimactic. You can kind of go two ways when you experience that. Number one is you go, oh, okay, this is actually isn't it. I got to go find something deeper and more meaningful. And then other people go, oh, it's not one Super Bowl that I needed. It's the most Super Bowls of all time. Then I'll have it.
Yes. And then it'll be never enough. You know, I've done motivational speaking, you know, as you have for a while. And, you know, I've done work with presidents and very known and very powerful, you know, people. And I remember on stage people asking me, oh, what's like the most exciting thing you've done? And I was like, well, actually last week, my two dogs, we went on this walk and I saw the, you know, and they were like, are you serious? And I'm like, no, like I'm in the moment during those periods of life that you said, or, you know, you say are ordinary, but those are really the extraordinary moments in our life that we need to appreciate. The other day I'm driving home with my daughter after a very long day at the gym, and we were both exhausted, and we see a double rainbow that she points out, and she's screaming and so giddy and so excited, you know, and just kind of like, that's a moment that I'll never forget. And, you know, just recognizing, you know, her, you know, reaction to that and how exciting. And then we started talking about a beach trip we had, goodness, I guess it was a couple of years ago, where we saw a double rainbow then, and she remembered. I was like, how does she remember that? It was years ago. But it's those little moments and appreciating those that truly are gifts, and they are the extraordinary moments in our life that we will hold on to. But many of us see them as ordinary. We don't appreciate them. We don't recognize the beauty in them. And so we always think we've got to be on top of that podium. We've got to win not just one Super Bowl, like you said, but multiple Super Bowls. And that's when I'm going to be fulfilled. And I truly think everything that will fulfill us in life, it's right in front of us. Just many of us choose not to see it. And I went through life many years not seeing it. And it is my husband that kind of opened my eyes to the fact that it's truly those simple, simple, simple moments in life that are truly gifts for all of us.
Yeah. And I just love how timeless that idea is too. I mean, you go back to the Stoics, and, you know, Marcus Aurelius is the emperor of Rome. And he's like, what is this? He's like, so I have like a fancier cloak than other people. Like, this doesn't change anything, you know? Or, you know, 500 years ago, Blaise Pascal said, all of humanity's problems stem from our inability to sit quietly in a room alone. Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh yeah, if I could just be here, like with this, whether it's cleaning up the gym in the morning, or, mm-hmm. you know, I bet I love that experience of getting somewhere early, you're turning the lights on, mm-hmm. you know, and they're flickering up, you know, like when I get into my office in the morning and just, I'm the first one there, there's no one there, it's quiet, and I get to dig into this thing I love. Like, to me, that's
way more satisfying than, a chunk of a royalty check or, a profile in a newspaper or something. It's weirdly being able to sort of tap into the sort of humanness of it. I think that's the most wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Very true. I mean, I guess, as we are both, very accomplished individuals, I know many people listen and be like, well, of course they feel that way because they've accomplished certain things or whatever, don't have certain life struggles or challenges, they think. But I will say the happiest people that I know in life are the people that have very little, and that they're, it's about their relationships. It's about the simple things in life, and they are living a much less stress-filled life than many of us ever could.
Right. Yeah. Blessed are the meek. I think too, when I think, although I'm sort of very privileged and like you, I've made some money and I have some nice things, but like the things that I'm most happy about, the things that I enjoy the most, were not at all a function of the success or the privilege. Do you know what I mean? It's it's not the car that makes me happy. If you told me I had to sell the car and get a different car, that isn't what would get me up out of bed in the morning. It would be where I'm driving the car and what I get to do. It's just because someone has something, like the Stoics talk a lot about this. They're like, look, it's better to be rich than poor if you had a choice, but a wise sort of successful person should be able to be happy with either, because the external thing isn't actually changing what you're feeling inside.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't fulfill you. We just packed up and moved to come a little closer to the gym. And I realized how many things I have. My husband thinks I'm a hoarder, but I'm like, everything is sentimental. He's like, no, that scarf is not sentimental.
You've never right.
And one thing that I did realize is I said to the movers, I was like, you know what? Let's leave these boxes in the garage and see how much I really need and miss these items. And I really don't miss the stuff. And if someone, if I had to, leave a vehicle or whatever, somewhere and I would never see it again, that vehicle or what have you definitely did not, fulfill me. It's definitely the relationships, that we have and such, in life, not the things. And I think we do think the things will fulfill us, or the accomplishments and the accolades will fulfill us, or the amount of money will fulfill us. And when you do achieve that, there is this emptiness like, oh, wait, I didn't get the satisfaction that I thought I would. And, if you recognize that and you learn from it, then you'll, strive to focus on the things that will fulfill you. And that's honestly relationships and impact and, pursuing things you love and not going after things.
And here's me talking to NASCAR champion Brad Keselowski. Well, I was going to ask you about reading because that's how we got connected. You're clearly a big reader. Is that another thing you do as far as training the mind, or is it more training your sort of what role does reading play in being the best race car driver in the world?
The number one reason why I read is to be a better leader.
Okay.
Hands down. Now, there is some things that I read that help me in the car. Most of it is for out of the car. Now, that said, I might find some book tomorrow that has all these tricks and tips. But a large part of what my role is as a race car driver is out of the car. And people don't see that. And I can respect that they don't understand it. But I have a team of people that kind of riding a roller coaster of emotions. Let me back up a little bit, Ryan. In motorsports, you are a Hall of Famer if you win one out of every 10 races. Like, it's one of the lowest averages in all sports. Right? Everybody talks about baseball. 300, Hall of Famer. Motorsports, like 100 is Hall of Famer. It's super difficult to win a race. It's a lot of competition. You're competing against 40 guys every week. There's only one winner. 10% is amazing, phenomenal. Okay, that means you have way more bad weeks than good weeks. Even if you're a Hall of Famer, 9 out of 10 weeks, you did not win.
Yeah.
And so you have this team around you of people who are, they're going to feed off that energy. And that energy is always going to be the same of we've got to improve. We've got to improve. What did we learn this week? How are we going to apply the lessons, right? And it's this really tight feedback loop because it's weekly. We compete 35, 36 weeks a year. So you have 36 weeks a year of PDCA, plan, do, check, act. Plan the next race, do the race, come back and check on it. How did it go? All right, now we got to act on it. These are all the things that went wrong that we have to patch up to be better. Well, basically in that is an acknowledgement that we failed and we didn't meet all of our goals. So mentally, this is really tough on a team, right? You're always failing. Even races you win, you're like, all right, we might have done 99.9% everything right, but we failed here.
Sure.
We got to fix it. We got to fix it. That might cost us next week, right? So that can be really demoralizing on a team to always have area to improve. And I think you asked me where I read, and I'm finally circling this back to it. One of the things I spend a lot of time on is trying to find ways to effectively lead a team to constantly be addressing its weaknesses without falling apart mentally and without taking it the wrong way. How do I convey that message? How do I build systems that naturally convey that message in a positive way? And so I think that's a lot of the studying and reading that really I dig into and look for.
What have been some of the books that have hit you the most?
There's one I really love right now, and I don't know if you've read it. It's called Debrief to Win.
No, I'm writing this down.
So Debrief to Win is a book wrote by a F-16 fighter pilot. And, you know, aviation, specifically military aviation, defense aviation, is its own animal altogether.
Sure.
But what I love about studying the military is they have the ultimate consequence.
Right. It's life or
death.
Mess
up, you die.
Yeah.
And out of that comes this accountability because nobody wants to die.
Yeah.
Right. If you want to die, you probably don't make it into the role of an F-16 fighter pilot. Like, there's enough pre-screening in there. So with respect to that, nobody wants to die. And when they get close to dying and they live through it, they come back and they fix it. High level of accountability, right? And that's not just an F-16 fighter pilot, anywhere in the military where you're in combat, right? And so they've created all these different systems of, again, like Debrief to Win really documents of how do we learn from our mistakes, apply them in a format that is very transient, right? Fighter pilots come and they go. You hope the reason they come and they go is because their time ends, but
they're retiring.
They're retiring, yes, but not always, right?
Yeah.
And there's hard lessons. What do you do when someone passes away in an accident and now you've lost the entire morale of the team, confidence, et cetera, right? They've lived these experiences for, you know, almost 100 years and have really iterated the process of how to work through that. And Debrief to Win is a great illustration of that. The consequences are admittedly slightly higher than motorsports.
Sure.
But that's good. I want to learn from someone who has a format that's better than me. I don't want to play down. I want to play up. So it's probably one of my favorite books of all time.
Have you read, I use it as a source in Ego is the Enemy, but given your interest in military jets and then also leadership, have you read Boyd, the fighter pilot who changed the art of war?
No, but I'd love to. That okay, sounds so right up my eye.
He's one of the great fighter pilots of all time. He fights in Korea. He was called 42nd Boyd because he could basically take anyone down in 40 seconds. But he then becomes a fighter pilot, a fighter instructor at Nellis. But then he goes into the Pentagon where he becomes sort of a bureaucratic fighter. Mm-hmm. So his job, how do you get stuff out of a broken, flawed, you know, complicated, slow ass system? And he's the inventor of the F-15 and the F-16. He rams them through bureaucratically. So he was this reformer and sort of whistleblower. He's a fascinating person, but I think one of the great leadership books of all time that you would really, really enjoy.
I'm glad we're recording. If I can come back and watch this,
I'll follow up.
Yes.
Do you watch film? Well, now I have to ask you because I can't do it. Do you watch film of your own appearances?
Like, oh, all the time.
Okay, yes. So you even evaluate yourself that way?
Oh, yes, all the time.
Wow.
It's I think it's critical. You know, one of the things that makes racing interesting, somebody brought up to me actually just this morning. In most sports, you have a coach.
Sure.
There's no coach as a driver. Like, I don't know why, but the sport iterated away from it. Maybe it's egos. I don't know.
Yeah.
There are a few people who have like trainers. I should say it. Most drivers have trainers. Most professional drivers have trainers, but very few coaches. And I think one of the issues or reasons behind that is, like, if unless you live it as a driver, kind of like you don't have a lot of credibility.
Yeah.
And coaching is not really a super glamorous job for those that have raced in the past. So there's usually not a lot of successful motorsports coaches. So you're really reliant most times on your own ability to teach yourself.
Interesting.
And the best way that I've found to do that is watching film over and over again.
I meant, do you watch like interviews you do to see where you could do you watch all kinds of things if you do to critique?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. So media stuff. Yes.
Yeah.
That
wow.
Too. Yes.
Okay.
Oh yeah.
I can't
absolutely.
Do it. It's too uncomfortable.
It is. It's super uncomfortable. It's super uncomfortable. So I'll watch it with my wife and I'll be like, I consume the majority of my media on my phone.
Yeah.
And I'll like in the middle of it, kind of put my phone to the side and just go into listen only mode to be less uncomfortable. But there's something in the human brain that hates hearing itself.
Yes. Well, you said someone told me this about an audiobook that because of like how your head works, you hear your voice differently when it's coming out of your own mouth than when it's recorded.
Mm-hmm. It has something to do with the base of your voice that your brain recognizes versus what's recorded.
I mean, I to go to this idea of a coach and a team sport, I think people loosely understand that what you do is a team sport, but you know, like a basketball is a team sport with four other people who do what you do, which, mm-hmm. you know, it'd be like, I don't know, if a golfer was also responsible for overseeing the manufacturing of their clubs and the design of the golf, like you're basically like the athlete and then the CEO of this organization of people who do integral parts. Their job is integral to you doing your job, but it's not at all the same as your job, you know, mechanics and, you know, all that. That must be a weird kind of leadership where nobody is really on the same page as far as what their task in the larger task is.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's, I got to that position, Ryan, because it's how I was successful. I've never considered myself to be the most talented race car driver. I've had moments where I'm like, man, that was awesome. I'm really proud of myself. But I've never sat back and said, oh, I'm the most talented race car driver ever. So through the course of my career, where I started to find success came through being a good race car driver who had great leadership abilities. And that meant being able to iterate, being able to, you know, recognize patterns, and then effectively play ahead. Now, in a perfect system, I wouldn't have to do that. In a perfect system, there would be all these people around me that did that, and you know, everything clicked and was miraculous, et cetera, et cetera. That's a lot easier said than done, because recognizing again that the tools that are limited for the team to work with respect to recognition patterns, onboard telemetry effectively, they don't have a lot of tools to analyze, and they make a lot of great decisions, and you can make a lot of great decisions with good info, but when you don't have the complete information, you're bound to make some bad ones too.
Demand more of yourself in 2022. And one of the ways you can do that is by joining us in the Daily Stoic New Year, New You Challenge. All you have to do is go to dailystoic.com/challenge to sign up. Remember, Daily Stoic Life members get this challenge and all our challenges for free. But sign up, seriously. Think about what one positive change, one good new habit is worth to you. Think about what could be possible if you handed yourself over to a little bit of a program. We all pushed ourselves together. That's what we're going to do in the challenge. I'm going to be doing it. I do the challenges, all of them, alongside everyone else. I'm looking forward to connecting with everyone in the Discord challenge and all the other bonuses. Anyways, check it out. New year, new you, the Daily Stoic Challenge. Sign up at dailystoic.com/challenge. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts.
You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I didn't want to, I was like, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shea Serrano. And we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the f***ing best.
Each week, Shea Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out six pop culture-themed trophies for six basketball-related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto, I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill You Might Win Some But You Just Lost One trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make Six Trophies your go-to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that just saved Abercrombie?
Or the tech acquisition that was just like Game of Thrones?
Or the one financial equation that can solve climate change?
Then check out our daily podcast, The Best One Yet, or as we call it, T-Boy.
This is Nick.
This is Jack.
And we pick the three most interesting business news stories every day for the perfect mix.
20 minutes each morning, you're going to feel brighter.
We call it Pop Biz, don't we, Jack?
Where pop culture meets business news. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies,
or you're going for that promotion at work,
or you just want to know the trends before your friends,
feel brighter by starting your morning with us every weekday.
Listen to The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your pods.
You can listen to The Best One Yet ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts.
With shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, and many more, Wondery means business.